To introduce our first speaker for this afternoon, George Paul. He's been collecting the artifacts of recorded sound since 1967. He's written many articles on the subject and is co-author, along with Tim Fabrizio, of the Talking Machine and Illustrated Compendium. A licensed speech language psychologist. Obviously need some of that now, right? Yes, thank you. He's with his family in Western New York. He's going to talk to us today about Opportunity Lost, the American Graphophone Company, and its six-inch cylinders. This is a family thing, right? Okay.
Oh, okay. Six inch.
You know what? Well, good afternoon. No, not today. This is my first ARSC conference, and I had no idea it was such a rowdy group. I must say that I am delighted. My name is George, and I'm a romantic. I feel better for having admitted that, even though as an historian, I must keep these romantic impulses in check, because we deal with fact, not supposition, in our quest for the truth. After all, we've each had our own painful experiences at the hands of someone else's romantic notions. For instance, the bizarre amalgamation of various talking machine parts that's described as a prototype, or the Edison Diamond Disc record missing its labels, badly scarred, yet exorbitantly priced, offered as a test pressing. These are examples of other people's romantic notions that are too often not grounded in known facts. I'd like to present to you this afternoon a romantic perspective of Opportunity Lost, which is built upon the factual incidents surrounding the application of six-inch length cylinders by the American Graphophone Company. In point of fact, the Graphophone Company and its later affiliate, the Columbia Phonograph Company, developed and marketed four distinct types of six-inch cylinders by 1905. It's the failure of these efforts that's the basis for this presentation. The six-inch long cylinder dates from 1885, when Alexander Graham Bell, Chichester Bell, and Charles Sumner Tainter developed the world's first practical, removable, and replayable record. This, the world's first portable recording medium, was comprised of a cardboard tube 6 inches long, 1 5/16 diameter, with a thin, non-shavable coating of ozocerite applied to its surface. In the context of the mid-1880s, this was a remarkable cylinder. For the first time, a recording could be removed from the machine, placed upon another, and reproduced numerous times with no significant loss in quality. The record was entirely self-supporting, needing no mandrel. The recordings were for the first time engraved or incised, not embossed. The Bell-Tainter feed screw had 160 threads per inch pitch. At 100 revolutions per minute, utilizing 5.5 inches of the cylinder's surface, a recording of over 8.5 minutes was possible. Here, at the birth of the industry, was the germ of tremendous possibility. For the moment, however, the 6-inch ozocerite cylinder was hamstrung by its playback apparatus, the graphophone. Treadle-powered, mounted on a heavy table, and capable of only limited volume, the graphophone was ill-suited to demonstrate to the world the ozocerite cylinder and its engraved recording. By June of 1888, Edison had introduced his own engraved wax cylinder. His chief chemist, Jonas Eilsworth, had developed an improved wax compound and increased the cylinder diameter to 2 1/8, making it both reusable and shavable. Moreover, the phonograph, designed to record and play the new cylinder, was a far superior machine to the treadle-driven graphophone. The improved Edison phonograph used an electric motor, was reasonably portable, although weighing nearly 60 pounds, and was equipped with recording and reproducing diaphragms larger than the graphophones, resulting in greater volume of sound. Amidst all these improvements lay one ominous fact. The revolutionary new Edison cylinder, which was to become the industry standard, was only 4 inches long, capable of playing only approximately 3 minutes at 100 RPM. It's unclear exactly why the Edison 4 settled on the new 4-inch length for its cylinder. Edison himself seemed unconcerned with the relatively short recording time available on his new cylinder. In an 1888 tract entitled Description of the Phonograph and Phonograph Graphophone by Their Respective Inventors, Edison merely mentions the convenience obtained by observing uniformity in the machines themselves. Quote, "For the present, it has been decided to make all the phonographs of uniform size so that a record put upon the machine in New York may be placed upon another machine of the same pattern in China and speak exactly as it was spoken to on this continent. Each wax blank will receive from 800 to 1,000 words, and of course, several blanks may be used for one document if needed. This uniform size and pattern make the thing perfectly practicable in offices which have business connections all over the globe," unquote. Now, aside from the oblique reference to using several blanks if needed, Edison also mentioned other dimensions of cylinders. Quote, "On 4 cylinders, 8 inches long, with a diameter of 5, I can put the whole of Nicholas Nickleby in phonogram form." Well, the obvious question to such a claim at the time would have been, what talking machine is capable of playing these 8-inch cylinders? Clearly, a man of Edison's quick turn of mind would have been aware of the limitations imposed by the 4-inch length of his new cylinders. Nevertheless, the 4-inch length, once decided upon, was Edison's standard cylinder format for the next 30 years. One might well wonder why the American Graphophone Company, with a 6-inch cylinder format already in place, would have abandoned it. In point of fact, they didn't, not yet. Two situations developed simultaneously in the late 1880s and early 1890s that greatly influenced the course of events. Jesse Lippincott's North American Phonograph Company was offering a choice of the phonograph or the graphophone through local subsidiaries. These were primarily intended as business appliances to take the place of stenographers. The graphophone machine, with its serious drawbacks, was a failure, while the Edison phonograph as a machine proved to be at least marginally practical, despite its relatively short cylinder. At the same time, the gradual failure of the North American Phonograph Company was forcing its local operatives to offer musical cylinders to its customers. Since the only practical machine available to play them was the Edison phonograph, the musical cylinder format had to conform to the Edison 4-inch length. This is a Class M that's been modified to play with a coin slot. Increasing the surface speed of the cylinders improved the musical reproductions. Thus, playing time decreased proportionately from over 3 minutes at 90 RPM to 2.5 minutes at 120 RPM. Several local companies began large-scale production of musical cylinders in the Edison 4-inch format. Ironically, one of the most successful of these was the Columbia Phonograph Company of Washington, D.C., under the management of Edward Easton. It may be understood then that at this juncture, cylinder length was determined by the only practical talking machine. The cylinders themselves were seen by their respective inventors as merely an adjunct to the machine. Not everyone involved in the talking machine business agreed. During the first annual convention of local phonograph companies of the United States, held at Chicago, May 28th and 29th, 1890, the subject of cylinder length was discussed. A representative stated, quote, "One great objection to the machine in our territory is the length of cylinders. They are not of sufficient capacity to hold all the dictation that many users of the machine would like to subject them to. And it is our judgment that if a change is made in this direction, it would help very largely in the introduction of the machine and overcome in a measure some of these objections we find there is in both the phonograph and graphophone, more especially the phonograph in this respect." Mr. Smith of New Jersey amended a motion for a longer and stronger cylinder by stating, "My purpose was to have the end accomplished merely by lengthening the cylinders. If by changing the model, the thread per inch, the same end could be accomplished, why, it is better than to make the cylinder longer. What I want to accomplish is that the cylinder shall be made, or the length shall be modified, so as to have it hold more," unquote. Of course, the Edison phonograph of 1890 was incapable of playing anything other than 4-inch cylinders of 100-thread pitch. This was a prominent topic at the gathering, and in order for us to understand why cylinders developed as they did, it must be a prominent topic at today's gathering. On the first day of the 1890 convention, Chairman A.W. Clancy read a paper by J.C. Clarkson, which outlined the state of the present phonograph. Quote, "First, we will take the mechanism of the present phonograph. The instrument as a whole seems to us unnecessarily heavy and somewhat clumsy. We have found the recording and reproducing principle using the sapphire points to be excellent and enduring. The cutting off device, although very feasible at first sight, is not popular with our subscribers, especially when machines are used in connection with business. The cylinders are not well adapted to business uses, being large, heavy, not suitable for mailing, and very easily broken, and quite limited to capacity, that is, on a single surface. We would advise a single record cylinder, smaller in diameter, of greater length, and unbreakable. The starting and stopping device is clumsy, not well adapted to rapid use by typewriters or dictators. Any derangement in the adjustment of the instrument is not quickly and easily remedied. For instance, should the machine fail to run regular, it might be due to the tension of the governor belt, or of the main driving belt, or the pressure of the governor brushes, or oil insulating the same, or dirt, or pressure on the commutator brushes, derangement of the traveling thread on the main screw, looseness in some of the bearings, and perhaps other causes." Sounds great, doesn't it? "The main traveling or screw thread is very fine, unprotected, and easily damaged. To sum the whole matter up, we must have, for business purposes, a motor phonograph, smaller, more compact, and less liable to derangement in adjustment. Concerning the graphophone, the main faults of the machine as they occur to us are that the recording point is easily dulled, the diaphragm is liable to damage unless very carefully handled, the reproducer, we believe, can be made to do better work. Would suggest that a proper and in every way effective motor with a battery be adopted by the parent company in connection with the graphophone." Remember that point. Interestingly, in light of future developments, Edward Easton was the first to speak up at the conclusion of that lengthy paper by saying, "So far as Mr. Clarkson's criticisms of the graphophone are concerned, all he calls for in the way of improvements are now on hand and will be furnished at the earliest possible moment. Two or three points are already covered, and the rest are in the process of being covered," unquote. It can be seen that even at this early date, the limitations of the 4-inch cylinder were recognized, and the perpetuation of those limitations by the Edison phonograph was equally apparent. Yet industry leaders showed a myopic preoccupation with developing a more practical machine with little regard for its recording format. In order to fully appreciate this situation, the following account may prove illuminating. By mid-1890, the topic of phonographic improvements had prompted Edward Easton to offer suggestions on how the Edison phonograph could be improved. Edison's secretary, Samuel Insull, sent Mr. Edison a letter dated July 29, 1890, in which he wrote, "My dear Edison, I enclose you herewith a copy of a letter I've received from E.D. Easton of the Columbia Phonograph Company. I've written this gentleman today stating that if he is liable to be in New York within the next week or so, I would arrange for him to see you at your laboratory. To my mind, he is the most intelligent man in the phonograph business, and I am sure you would be very glad to meet him, and the interview would certainly be very profitable, as he is sure to have lots of suggestions to make." So Edison would learn. Easton's suggestions to Edison survive in a 3-page list of areas in need of improvement. And these included the stop and start, as mentioned by Mr. Clarkson in 1890, three hands required, where he says one hand holds the mouthpiece, the other hand manipulates the stop and start, while a third hand would be useful to handle papers and etc. He calls for a longer speaking tube, saying that the one in use at present is at least 8 inches too short. He covers the governor and the motor brushes. He mentions a cylinder gate. This is my favorite, the bell. Quote, "From the beginning, practical users of both phonograph and graphophone have constantly called for a little bell so placed on the machine as, like the typewriter, to warn the dictator when he is nearing the end of the cylinder. Every practical user will appreciate this point, which can be readily met at slight expense." He talks about reproducer adjustment, A very annoying feature of the present machine is the constant tinkering with the adjusting screw. He mentions protection of the 100-thread screw, talks about correspondence phonographs, and ends up by outlining a new arrangement. The opinion in general here, meaning the local subsidiaries of the North American Phonograph Company, is that if the entire mechanism could be rearranged, made much lighter and more compact, it would be desirable. The present phonograph occupies altogether too much space, is much too heavy, and is liable to create an impression that it is exceedingly complicated. It might be thought best in the rearrangement to conceal the motor and governor mechanism, which are now in sight, and yet have the arrangement such that an inspector or repairer could readily get at these parts." Unquote. From the foregoing suggestions, the modern collector of talking machines can trace the origins of the Edison automatic reproducer and the Type C commercial phonograph offered in Europe. It will also serve to illustrate, I hope, the tremendous emphasis on the development of a more successful talking machine as opposed to a better cylinder. Note in particular that Easton offered no suggestions to lengthen or otherwise increase the playing time of cylinders. The American Graphophone Company was not in a position to respond to suggestions for an improved talking machine until around 1893, when it offered recycled or unsold Bell Tainter upper mechanisms driven by electric motors and mounted in small wooden cabinets. The graphophone reproducers were enlarged to improve their volume. Despite the graphophone's unique ability to play 6-inch cylinders, detachable mandrels were supplied to accommodate Edison 4-inch cylinders. However, despite the graphophone's submission to the Edison-style cylinders, the company offered a new 6-inch cylinder of its own called the Type E. This new cylinder used the old Bell Tainter paper tube to support a thick wax surface of 2-inch diameter. Here was a cylinder capable of supplanting the Edison cylinder. Good enough, in fact, to create a demand for the much-improved electrically-driven graphophones created in response to customer demand. It was all possible. But inexplicably, the Type E cylinder was offered only as a blank, to be used as a dictation record. It's incredible to consider that Edward Easton, by this time in control of American Graphophone, and with much cylinder experience, would have been blind to the Type E cylinder possibilities. If used with a standard Bell Tainter feed of 160 threads per inch, the Type E cylinder, running at 120 RPM, would play for almost 7.5 minutes. At 100 RPM, a recording of 8 minutes 45 seconds was possible. Even using the Edison-style 100 thread per inch feed, the Type E cylinder would play for over 4.5 minutes. Had Type S coin-operated graphophones been supplied with commercially recorded Type E cylinders, such lengthy programs could have made serious inroads in the slot entertainment field, rendering Edison coin-ops obsolete. If Edward Easton was indeed aware of this potential, he evidently did nothing about it. Type E cylinders remained exclusively for business dictation. Easton's past and current cylinder success was with the 4-inch cylinder format. By 1895, Easton and his factory manager, Thomas McDonald, despite developing and marketing a successful talking machine spring motor, had still not grasped the opportunity offered by the Type E cylinder, and introduced the Type G Baby Grand graphophone and the successful Type N Bijou graphophone. These machines, by their design, played only the Edison-style 4-inch cylinders and were incapable of playing 6-inch cylinders. Their success, and that of the machines that followed, ensured the primacy of the 4-inch cylinder format. The only machines Edison had to offer in America in 1895 were virtually the same heavy, expensive electric phonographs in use since 1889. The new spring-driven graphophones were revolutionary machines. Why they were designed exclusively for the Edison-style cylinders rather than accommodating pre-recorded 6-inch cylinders remains a mystery. By mid-1897, the supply of old Bell Tainter mechanisms, being sold as the Type K, was exhausted. To replace this machine, Columbia introduced in September 1897 a new graphophone. This machine, the Type C Universal graphophone, was indeed a versatile machine, as stated in the catalog. Quote, The universal graphophone with the hour-run clockwork motor is well adapted to the use of the exhibitor. Such a graphophone, supplied with a well-selected stock of records, a large amplifying horn, and a crescent reservoir with an 11-way tube, will soon pay for itself in the hands of an enterprising exhibitor and return large profits." Unquote. Equipped with a triple spring motor, a 6-inch mandrel, and new 6-inch long Type C cylinders, the $50 Universal was an attractive alternative to Edison's $100 spring motor, or even the $40 single spring home. With its six-inch long cylinder, the third one offered by the company, the Columbia Phonograph Company could have offered the public over 4.5 minutes of recorded entertainment. Yet inexplicably, unbelievably, the Type C cylinder also was supplied only as a business blank. The dual potential of the universal graphophone and the Type C cylinder was allowed to slip away amidst two-minute Edison-style cylinders and Berliner discs of equally short duration. From 1897 until 1902, Columbia's marketing efforts led in several different directions. The company was a pioneer in developing and offering low-priced talking machines as an incentive toward sales of cylinders. Columbia exerted tremendous time and effort in several attempts to enter the disc talking machine and record market. The company introduced the 5-inch diameter cylinders to the public, offering a variety of machines to play them. Columbia was the first to offer superheated molded cylinders to the public, revolutionizing cylinder production. Yet, the company seemed unconcerned with the subject of playing time. The only machine in the industry capable of playing longer 6-inch cylinders, the Type C graphophone, was languishing as a business appliance, its entertainment potential forgotten in the absence of 6-inch entertainment cylinders. By 1902, cylinder speed had been standardized at 160 RPM, resulting in approximately 2 minutes of playing time. 10-inch disc records were now available and offered a slight increase in playing time over the 2-minute cylinders. The 6-inch cylinder, had Columbia only chosen to use it, could have leveled the playing field in the escalating war between cylinder and disc. The years between 1897 and 1905 were crucial ones in the development of the disc recording industry. By neglecting the potential of the 6-inch entertainment cylinder, Columbia allowed its early prominence in the field to slip away. Columbia finally recognized its mistake a decade too late. In April 1905, the company introduced its 20th century BC graphophone and 6-inch molded entertainment cylinders. The June 1905 issue of the Talking Machine World had this to say on the matter, quote, "In answer to an inquiry, we may say that in connection with the new loud-speaking graphophone just being marketed, a new line of gold-molded cylindrical records, very much longer than any heretofore made, will be added to the product of the Columbia Phonograph Company. The new cylinders are half a foot in length, incapable of containing all of an ordinary composition without its being cut. The new loud-speaking machine, which is made with an extra-long mandrel, afford splendid possibilities in the way of a larger cylinder record. About 12 of the new records have already been made, and additions will be listed from month to month." Unquote. In point of fact, the extra-long mandrel had been a feature of the Type C universal graphophone for almost 8 years. The addition of the high-end reproducer and fancy cabinet could not rescue the opportunity that had been lost. The new half-foot cylinders, conforming to the Edison 100 thread per inch feed and 160 RPM, could play for almost 3.5 minutes, but in 1905, this was no longer good enough. 12-inch discs were available by this time, easily meeting the threat of the 20th century half-foot cylinders, and an even larger obstacle was the millions of existing phonographs and graphophones equipped with 4-inch mandrels. Had Columbia not so readily surrendered to the Edison cylinder dimensions back in 1895, the complexion of the cylinder talking machine industry might have been substantially altered. The vibrant 4-inch cylinder industry, which Columbia had done so much to build, was the biggest enemy of their belated 6-inch cylinder. The 20th century cylinder in 1905 was a perfect example of too little, too late. Columbia's wax cylinders had but 4 more years of life. Both the 4-inch and 6-inch wax cylinders were discontinued after April 1909 in favor of Columbia's indestructible cylinder records, made of celluloid. Even these would survive only until May 1912. After offering both cylinders and disks for over a decade, Columbia abandoned the former and focused its remaining energies on the disk market. There are those who will assert that even had Columbia seized upon the 6-inch entertainment cylinder format in 1895 or earlier, and thus redefined the cylinder industry, the ultimate outcome would have been unchanged. Victor would still have become the ascendant force in the early industry, and the cylinder, 6-inch or otherwise, would have inevitably been relegated to the backwoods. Discs are easier to store than cylinders. Victor's advertising and recording department would have remained formidable opponents. In response to these observations, consider the following. 6-inch cylinders were used in business Ediphones and dictaphones into the 1940s, in an environment where utility was of paramount importance. Storage of 6-inch cylinders was not an insurmountable problem in the area of commerce. Several companies offered cylinder cabinets in 1907 whose shelves were meant to accommodate 6-inch cylinders. Also, how rapidly would the 7-inch and 10-inch disc market have grown in an environment dominated by 6-inch cylinders, technically superior and capable of playing 7 minutes 20 seconds? Would Victor have been capable of generating the revenue necessary to operate as it did? Would the field historically sown and harvested by Victor have been quite so fertile? Finally, one last consideration. After Columbia's October 1908 purchase of the Indestructible Record Company and its celluloid molding patents, the company could have introduced a 6-inch celluloid cylinder with 200 threads per inch. Such a cylinder would have been capable of playing 6 minutes 50 seconds with the volume and fidelity of a later Edison Blue Amberol. But beyond this, we enter into pure speculation. The 6-inch entertainment cylinder was a dream unrealized. Its impact, had it been unleashed in 1895, would have been substantial. In actuality, it was neglected for over a decade and finally dusted off too late to affect the battle it so easily could have won 10 years earlier. The 6-inch cylinder was Columbia's stepchild. An offspring of the American Graphophone Company, the ungainly youth was adopted and raised by Columbia, yet was not nurtured as was Columbia's own 4-inch Edison-type cylinder. The favored child was schooled in the arts and called upon to sing, while the 6-inch stepchild, despite its latent talent, labored in drab utility. Only in its young adulthood was the firstborn allowed to perform before an audience. Its stage career was brief, but enough people admired its talent and work ethic to allow it a long life of service, far outliving its famous sibling and the forces which gave it birth. Thank you. I need to acknowledge some kind people
whose certain items out of whose collections appeared in these slides, and that includes Sam Sheena, Charlie Hummel, Larry Schlick, Bill Coker, Jean-Paul Agnard, and Steve and Ellie Sacente. Are there any questions? I know there's one question because Kurt had his hand up.
Given what all it took to produce brown wax cylinders in the early years, having to make them one at a time and then mechanically pantographing and so forth, do you think that all of that contributed to a decision to stick with a 4-inch format?
It's possible, but insofar as pantographing is concerned, I don't see where lengthening the format would have complicated the process other than replacing the mandrels. Right.
Maybe they felt that tying up the artist for 50% more time, maybe they wouldn't receive the economic profit that they would have.
I don't believe artists were paid so much by time as they were by selection, were they?
Yeah, but fewer cylinders
could
be made.
Yeah, fewer cylinders could be made.
That's
the same amount of time.
In the same amount of time, fewer cylinders could be made. It's an interesting point. I guess I would be surprised if, as I hope I've made clear in my paper, that Columbia or any of the cylinder companies were really focused on the cylinders at all in those early years. But that is an interesting point. Yes, Tim.
Yeah, there are a couple of other factors that you didn't mention that I think might have been a factor.
Please do.
In the mid-90s,
one of which is that Columbia and anybody supplying musical cylinders were supplying the exhibition trade almost exclusively at that time.
Yes.
And the installed base of machines there would have been all, virtually all, as you say, Edison for short cylinders, large cylinders, meaning that there are people they're selling to want for the shorter cylinders. They would have had to change that machinery completely in order to do that. Secondly, remember that 1893 was one of the worst depressions in the second half of the 19th century.
Absolutely.
All of these companies were struggling to just stay afloat at that time.
Right.
A little like the Vickers LPs of the 30s, maybe a good idea at a time when nobody was going to buy it.
The timing was undeniably bad for Columbia or for anyone in the mid-1890s to be changing machinery. But Columbia had somewhere in the area of 2,500 of those unsold and unleasable Bell Tainter mechanisms, which they quite successfully modified to electric motor format. They put in those small cabinets, and they were capable of playing the Type E cylinders. There really wouldn't have been a lot of tooling up to provide that, and that's why I showed the slide of the Type S coin-operated Columbia machine.
More the buyer than the seller.
Well, could be, yeah. Yes?
One of the things would be that, you know, to consider would be the length of the selections that they might want to record anyway, and this machine was not really set for, like, a classical piece, which would be the most likely to use the longer lengths. But one thing which they could have done on the coin-ops is have two or three selections on cylinders. As you were saying, some of them could be as long as 8.5 minutes. Mm-hmm. They can have maybe three or four different selections and be able to now still have the same turnover, because they would want people putting their penny or their nickel and not sit there for 8 minutes, but sit there for only 2 or 3 minutes. But they could have had two or three different selections on it, and a mechanism just like the music boxes that also would have a rotation of 15 or 16 selections. This machine would now have a rotation, let's say, of 3 selections.
Mm-hmm.
It would stop after the first one. You put another nickel in. The person would not have a choice of the first or the second selection.
Right.
Hear the second. The next person would hear the third selection. Then they could go back to the beginning. They'd have the same turnover, but they would now have 3 times the number of musical selections. And that would have been, if anybody had thought of that in the phonograph meetings, that would have been what would have really been the monetary advantage to the longer cylinder.
Absolutely. I can see I presented this in the right venue, because there are a lot of interesting ideas, several of which I haven't thought of. But I cannot believe
that... We're 100 years too late, though.
That's right. Where were we? But it's hard to believe that a guy like Thomas MacDonald or Edison himself, though, wouldn't have seized on these things, or some Edward M. Emmett, a number of early inventors who demonstrated their brilliance, and it was so easy. It was right there in front of them. And the fact that eventually in 1905 they came to that realization, I think, more or less proves that it was an opportunity that they missed out on.
Those cylinders are physically very rare, aren't they?
Well, they are. And some people say it's because of their fragility. I tend to lean more toward the wax composition. I mean, it's tough to find any Columbia cylinder in good condition.
I've never seen those two middle ones, the thick cardboard one.
The Type E and the Type C. Those are both extremely rare.
I've seen the oldest.
But they were business cylinders.
Yeah.
They were business cylinders.
Those were the ones I used to call the blue cylinders because of the molding.
Now, I thought that the blue cylinders were the 4-inch format that John English had developed.
The English had developed. You're right.
Okay.
I think Mike's point about his using the 6-inch cylinder for the jukebox trade actually brings up another point as to why they didn't go to that format, because do you want a guy who's going to sit there and put his nickel in for 6 minutes or 3 minutes or 2 minutes? Again, you're talking about economics here.
Yeah, but you'd have to put in a new nickel for the second
selection.
Yeah,
but you're talking about a whole different mechanism to stop, you know, twice at a cylinder. I'm
right.
talking about what they would probably be thinking of initially is, now we're offering 50% more music. And that's that much more time we're not getting nickels thrown into these machines.
The point that I tried to make was that by even by giving the public more, I mean, perish the thought.
More for their money.
Yeah, I mean, giving them more for their money, they could have just, you know, usurped Edison's, I shouldn't say Edison's trade, but the trade in Edison phonograph and Edison cylinders. If they had recorded the Type E cylinders with the same quality as the 4-inch format had been, I know where I'd drop my nickel. Yes.
I think, again, picking up where Mike at from Mike's first comment, I see a lot of parallels today with the compact disc. if you think of the consumer who remembers paying $7.98, $8.98 for an LP record, and all of a sudden the compact disc came out at $15, $16, $17, and this is a lot more, but yes, you could get 70 minutes worth of music. And now people began to realize what a 70-minute CD of pop music had to get filled out with something, and I really liked just the one the way it was. There's a lot of superfluous information. Why don't you go back and give me a CD at the same price as my LP record, then just give me the LP music, except for classical music, which, of course, had its say here. You could do the Cohen and Peasant Overture in one cylinder instead of, say, parts two or an original one. I just can't think of 6 minutes of some of these popular songs, which if you listen to on a Blue Emerald record when it was reissued from a two-minute record, they're just singing the song a second time, and I usually tend to play my two-minute record.
How about a six-minute Uncle Josh? How much laughing can you take?
Don't forget the Tin Pan Alley is essentially a 32-bar type.
Yeah.
For a long time.
Yeah, the opportunity for extra verses was certainly there. Yeah.
Well, not necessarily desired.
Well, maybe not desired, and of course I can't speak to that, but... I have a question way in the back.
Perhaps, again, the opportunity here, the public isn't necessarily going to be sitting down to listen to, I think, the dance aspect. Yeah, if I had 6 minutes to dance with my sweetheart, you bet I'd want that, not 2 minutes. So I think sitting down and listening is one aspect of music.
So is your point then that a person would just as soon drop a nickel for 2 minutes as 4 minutes?
As a consumer, I would prefer 6 minutes.
Okay, so would I.
I'll just observe, though, that pursuant to that, the use of the phonograph for dance.
We have a comment right down here. Oh, great. Thank you.
The use of the phonograph as a dance vehicle didn't really emerge until after 1910. Yeah.
Right.
And perhaps if that association had been made, and you could have, with a single winding, gotten a 6 or 7 minutes vehicle for dancing, that could have been the key, but those two things didn't come together in time.
And moreover, on the basis of the later success of the Edison 4-minute cylinders, I would tend to agree that the length in format, regardless of what was put on it, was enough to induce the public to buy them. I mean, they were certainly embraced at the time.
The springs long enough to play that? Play that length? Would the springs last long enough to play that length?
Well, what springs for what machine are you...
On the what Columbia was selling, their springs lasted 6, 7, 8 minutes on one winding?
Well, certainly on the Type C, that'll run 45 minutes or so on a winding, yeah. Absolutely. Had one way in the... Yes. Could you stand up, please? Absolutely. And that's why I didn't offer suggestions on what might be put on these cylinders, because I imagine we all have our own ideas of what we would have liked to have listened to. But the possibility technically was there. And for those of us who love opera, you know, who knows if they could have induced someone. That's right. Just think of what Lionel Mapleson could have done with 6-inch cylinders.
He got the last note in.
Those last notes would all have been in there. Yes, ma'am.
Your presentation brought back a lot of memories. In 1968, 1940, I was taking transcribing letters on these machines, and we were shaving them. And we used them quite often, but I don't know how long they lasted, and I don't recall Edison. I think it was an early dictaphone.
Well, there were dictaphones, and there were also Ediphones, which was a competing product. They were virtually the same. And now someone will yell at me here. I mean, I don't.
Remember those?
Yes. Yes.
Is there anything in the music trades to indicate the dealer's impressions of the six-inch cylinders and the way the public reacted or not reacted?
I think I'll defer to my my friend and colleague Tim Fabrizio, who has examined the music trades, and I have not.
I went through about 20 years of it, and I didn't really. I didn't see any kind of feedback about six-inch cylinders from dealers or from the public. Basically, what you find are sort of dummy articles that are placed there by publicists, you know, announcing how great stuff is, but really not saying much about what the public reaction is. So on my personal opinion is that the 6-inch 20th century cylinders were extremely fragile. I think George and I disagree on this, although
Tim has the right to be wrong now and then. It's okay. Go easy on him.
Yeah. I think they're very, very fragile, and I've seen plenty of evidence of this. But this points up even more strongly, puts further into relief the
time's up, Tim.
The inexplicable failure of Columbia to use a celluloid 6-inch cylinder, like the imperial records that were made by Lambert in Britain.
Yeah.
Because these things were so fragile, why didn't they do it? You know.
Mike.
Remember also that the 6-minute 14-inch 60 RPM Victor and Columbia disc was a failure at the same time, 1904-1905.
Well, that's true. And certainly the 14-inch Victor discs are undeniably fragile.
They're just unwieldy. Yeah, and they have at 60 RPM. They actually have very, very good sound.
Oh, they are. They're extremely
very good.
I have three of them, and they're all cracked. They're all hairlines, but still, my impression when I handle them is you know, you've really got to, you know, watch where you're walking with these plates.
I think they're fragile because they tend to stick out.
They do,
and I'm.
Well, they certainly are formidably made. Yes, yeah. I'm not aware of any disc record cabinets that accommodated them. There must have been something, but I've not seen anything in the talking machine world. And while I mentioned the talking machine world, I have gone through every page of that from the first issue in January of 2005 until sometime around 1916 or so, and. In the era of the 20th century cylinders, there was very little ballyhoo over them. I was surprised. I was expecting more, and there really was very little said about them. Is that Bill? Bill Klinger, yes.
Yeah, Rich asked what kind of reaction there was to the 20th century cylinders, like in the trade. I know Edison dealers shortly thereafter were asking Edison, are you coming out with
right.
a competing cylinder? Edison Phonograph Monthly has at least one or two mentions about that.
Yes.
The answer, no, we have no plans to do that. But it was about that same time, at least early in 1906, they began to look into doubling the groove pitch, different materials, even shellac as an alternative. So there was real interest in Edison defining a longer duration. It was something that would still be 4 inches long and fit on the same machines people already had.
Precisely. The millions of them that were in use by then, you couldn't ask them just to junk them in favor of the cylinder. Yes, Tim.
Just one point. There's been a lot of discussion here about what we think they should have done, what we would like to have seen on the cylinder. As you mentioned early on, and in terms of all the study I've done in this era, the Columbia, nothing else, was a very astute marketing company. They also were based on underpricing Edison drug.
most of their history and trying to give more for the buck than for a living. So to apply the term inexplicable, to me as a historian, says there probably was an explanation.
Well, you can usually follow the money, yes.
And that coupled with the lack of any kind of mention of this in the trade press, even the general issue, would suggest it was a non-issue at the time, either because nobody wanted more than that for short songs, they'd slow it down if they wanted a minstrel record, whatever, you can say the reasons why. Mm-hmm. But I have some objection to saying it inexplicable. It may be that we just haven't found the reasons.
Well, if I can defend my use of the word inexplicable, that was used in the context of the Type C graphophone and the Type C cylinders. I don't know what more it would have taken for Columbia to have issued the Type C 6-inch cylinder in an entertainment format. They had the Universal graphophone there all set to play it. And as I read out of the catalog excerpt, they were touting its the machine's entertainment potential. And yet, here was this... here was this cylinder just you know, on a silver platter that they virtually ignored except for business use. And to me, that's inexplicable. I mean, if you have...
Maybe, and
clearly Edward Easton was far more of a businessman than I am, which my friend Tim will be the first to tell you.
I think that what Tim just said has a lot to do with why they didn't do anything about the Type E cylinders, because they would have been more expensive.
Well, and of course, the only thing that could play the Type E cylinders were those early treadle tops from the Type C treadle graphophones.
There was plenty of that stuff around.
Well, 2,500 of them, or 2,700 of them.
You would be able to underprice Edison, and in addition to which, you're making, at that point, as you said, you're making cylinders for entertainment, public entertainment. And a lot of that stuff is going to be on Keller machines.
But if you jump from the Beltainer mechanisms to the Type C universal graphophone to the BC, I don't think there was a time when, until the demise of the BC, say around 1909, I don't think there was a time when Columbia did not have a machine capable of playing 6-inch cylinders. And the fact that they didn't introduce entertainment cylinders until 1905 is what gets me. But I think I'm hearing that my time is up. I want to thank you all very much for your kind attention.